Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 8 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, the Second Amendment podcast that has a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me is my hostess, Aaron Paulette. How you doing, Aaron?
Oh my god, you're disgustingly perky. I don't know if our listeners know this, but you are a morning person. Oh my god. You are like, when we were at NRA, you were just this domestic goddess getting up, you know, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed early in the morning, making breakfast. Meanwhile, I'm just there, need coffee. And so here you are, disgustingly perky today, and I am, it's been a week. I will not bore you with the details, but it's just been stressful. I have been a stress pony for just about the past week, and the weather hasn't helped. I know that people are not going to be surprised when I say that Florida rains a lot in the spring, but there's a cartoon floating around saying, Floridians be feeling like, and there's a picture of Florida, and pretty much everything south of Jacksonville is covered with the ocean. And yeah, that's what it feels like. It's been raining a lot. And, you know, I like the cold weather, or the cooler weather. I like the rain, but after a while, I'm starting to feel like I'm in Seattle or something. It's just, everything is gray and rainy. Everything is rain. It's all wet. It's rain. Life is rain, you know, and it gets to me after a while. I'm ready for some sunshine.
Meanwhile, here in New England, it can't make up its damn mind. It kind of went from winter directly to summer. Like, I left and it was just like cold and gray and the trees were bare for Dallas. And I came back and like the trees are in full leaf and it was hot. And then the other day it was like rainy and coolish and gross. And then the next day it was kind of raining a little bit. So we went out for like a family outing with some relatives that were coming by. And I wore my raincoat because I'm like, it's going to be rainy and crappy for a better part of the day. And like, it just turned out to just to be steamy and hot. And like, by the end of the day, I'm like, I think I've cooked myself. I think I'm not feeling so well. I immediately after we finished dinner, I took an ice cold shower and got out and went, oh, now I'm functioning. So that was the trick.
Yeah. That's the thing. Cool showers after just walking the dogs really helps and you know, prevents that whole stinky pit syndrome, which everyone finds so attractive, I found.
I love stinky pits. I'm super into them.
You know, we really need to nominate your wife for sainthood. I don't know how she does it.
Oh, well, there's a lot of people that want to answer to that question. And you know what? I can't answer that. I look at her and go, I mean, what's wrong with you besides the, you know, massive amounts of missing brain?
Sweetheart, I love you, but you traded down.
So you know what? Speaking of drama, I had to bring this up for the show. We both have blogs for those that think that we just live in podcast world. And you sent me the draft for a blog post saying, you know, what do you think about this? And well, then like an hour later, you said, I said, I'll read it. And then an hour later, you said, are you still reading it? And I'm like, oh, I started reading it. And then my daughter decided she was bored of doing what she was going to do and was going to start destroying the furniture. And so I had to remedy that. And then I was like, oh, I'll get back to you. And I said, no, there's nothing I can add to that. But you wrote a great piece that I wrote on the coattails of the, I will add a small amount of stuff, but Aaron's the expert here. I mean, you said everything perfectly about Oliver North as the new NRA president.
Yeah. And that got us some drama.
It got us some drama. So I think I will lead out with a statement that I ended up making in the comment section of my blog is, I'm not going to say anything about who Oliver North is, his spirit, his nature, how good of a man or bad of a man or anything like that of who he is. All I'm speaking about is who Oliver North is in the zeitgeist of American politics, and specifically American politics to those of us who are watching the news in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah. To use a buzzword, we're talking about optics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a very good
one. And the optics of appointing Oliver North as the NRA president is really, really bad. And I made the following analogy, and it upset some people. And the analogy was that appointing North to be the NRA president is the equivalent of appointing Casey Anthony to be president of the Girl Scouts. And people took that to mean I was maligning his character. And I'm not saying anything about the gentleman's character. I'm saying the way it looks.
Why don't you break down that analogy a little bit? Because you broke it down very, very nicely. Yeah, I could see how people could interpret it that way. That's not a crazy assumption, but your breakdown of that analogy really framed it up beautifully. And I have to agree with.
All right, so let me break it down. Casey Anthony was found not guilty of murdering her daughter, Kaylee. Even though she has been declared innocent in the eyes of the law, she would still be a bad choice as the head of anything involving children because, innocent or not, she still has that specter of child murder surrounding her. Similarly, Oliver North was convicted of felonies related to gun running, though later determined to be innocent and those convictions vacated. He still has the specter of gun running surrounding him, which makes him a bad choice as the head of anything involving firearms, regardless of his actual innocence. He was investigated for the Iran-Contra arms smuggling scandal. We're not even going to touch on that. It's very complicated.
Yeah, it's very complicated, and yeah, we're also not going to take a stand on how we side with the Contras.
Right. I mean, if you ask me, I'll tell you, but not in this podcast. He was investigated for that. He was not found guilty for anything involving the actual transfer of arms. He was convicted on, I believe it was withholding evidence, destroying evidence, things like that. Things which were found later on as people investigated him for it. So it's not like he was convicted for the gun smuggling, but it's still all one big association. And anyone who was there in the 80s mentioned Oliver North, you are going to think smuggling weapons to the Contras in Nicaragua. And the problem is that since so many people believe that the entire purpose of the NRA is to facilitate shady arms deals, mm-hmm. cough, cough, gun show loophole, cough, cough, having someone who was the poster boy, right or wrong, for shady arms deals to become their president is so incredibly tone deaf and short-sighted and possibly even self-defeating.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, again, this is no saying on what he's going to do as president. And let's be honest, I mean, the president of the NRA is a bit of a paper tiger, but there is times when there can be benefits made from the position. I talked a lot about Charlton Heston being a guy that brought the NRA to the forefront of a lot of things, instead of it being kind of an inside club deal. As a lot of people don't know who the current president is, don't really know what the NRA is doing. They just know it's a thing and it's out there. And Charlton Heston really kind of brought America to the, you know, to the NRA annual meeting, so to speak. And, you know, and he said a lot of things, like specifically the cold dead hand speech. Like, it's still like, I was just on Joan Peterson's blog. She's the former president of Protect Minnesota. And she had the clip of Charlton Heston doing the, from my cold dead hand speech on her blog, like the other day and, you know, within the last week or so. And so it's still getting under their skin. And yet it's still also a rallying cry for our side. So that's awesome. And that's good. And it's not something that we talk about. That was a bit of a short-sighted room. and so there are things to be gained from having a good NRA president. I also talked about Sandy Frohman, who was the president when I first joined the NRA. And I really liked her as president, even though I think most people don't know who she is. But I liked the fact that she was a Jewish woman from the San Francisco Bay Area and the president of the NRA. Like, come at me, bro. Like, attack that. Go ahead. It's good optics. It's very, very good optics. And this, I just don't see. And then on top of that, I got thinking about when dealing with all the people talking about, you know, Colonel North and all that. And I realized that, like, most years that I've been going to the NRA annual meeting as press, like, you go into the press room and they've got, you know, what's going on in the main stage playing on a big screen. And so you can see what's happening at the convention the whole time just by stepping into the press office. And it's a great place just to sit down and, you know, easier sore feet for a few minutes and maybe get some refreshments. And so I like going to the press room and just seeing what's going on that I might have missed. And every year I've seen Oliver North give a speech and I haven't really paid attention to it. But at the same time, like, it none of them have ever come back for me to hear. I hear, you know, Donald Trump's speech at the NRA, every few months somebody will play a clip from it or something like that because, you know, they're useful. But Oliver North, I'm entirely unaware of him except for who he was, you know, in the Reagan administration, and that, yes, he's still around, and yes, he's a very active part in the NRA, which, good for him on that. But other than that, you know, he hasn't been making any horrible Ted Nugent remarks, but at the same time, he also hasn't been making any, you know, great Charlton Heston remarks.
Yeah, I have absolutely no problem with him being on the board of directors. I just don't think he makes a very good president. And although I could be wrong, I would love to be wrong.
I hope we're wrong.
So regarding the figurehead situation, I have tried to explain to various people what the NRA president does and what they don't do. And the best way I have come to describe it is to use the analogy of Great Britain, where the NRA president is the king or queen. They are a figurehead. They look pretty for cameras. They say some things. They maybe chart the vague direction of the NRA during their term, but that's about it. They don't really do much. The person who actually does things is the executive vice president, which would be Wayne LaPierre, who in this case, for the analogy, would be the prime minister. The prime minister is the person who gets stuff done, but they aren't as photogenic. And so the NRA president is a combination of being the King of England and being Miss USA. You get out there, you look pretty, you wave, you talk about what you want to accomplish during your term, and when you're done, that's it. Meanwhile, the EVP is going to be charting the course for decades. I mean, Wayne's been doing this since the 90s, and no one's going to force him out. He knows where the bodies are buried. Wayne is going to quit when he decides to quit, and that's it. But my biggest concern, just personally, with the appointment of Oliver North doesn't have to do with the optics. It has to do with what his particular choice means. Peter Brownell, who was the previous president, someone I have immense respect for, his goal was inclusion. And he wanted to include everyone under the big Second Amendment tent. And he may have made some people uncomfortable. He may have bucked some trends in wanting to get queer voices and trans voices and all these people under the NRA blanket because the Second Amendment is for everyone. But he stepped down, and that's no longer policy. New policy is going to be whatever Oliver North decides it's going to be. And my fear is he's still a Marine. You appoint a Marine to fight. Businessmen negotiate, Marines fight. We've seen since Parkland, at least, that our Second Amendment rights are very much under attack. And I get the feeling that the board of directors decided, well, if they want to fight, let's give them a fight. And they're buckling down to have that fight. The problem is that they are skewing right. And the harder right they skew, the less likely it is to get more people under that big Second Amendment tent. Because how many members of the NRA are there? It's what, between 5-6 million, something like that? Okay. And just back of the napkin envelopes here, we've got, let's round. Let's say we've got 300 million people in the United States. I know it's closer to 325. And last I heard, about a third of them admitted to being gun owners. Okay, so we've got a nice round number of 100 million gun owners in the United States. If 5 million people can make politicians nervous, 100 million people can make politicians crap their pants. Why is the NRA not trying to get those other 95 million people under their tent where they can not only become far more effective politically, but also bring in a lot more revenue? And it seems like instead of building a broader base so they can have more power, they are responding to attacks from the hard left by skewing further and further right, and the only people that will be attracted by that are either Second Amendment absolutists or the very hard right conservatives, and that's going to leave a lot of people who are pro-gun but not pro-conservative feeling left out. Just as an example here, one of the things the NRA is tying into, because it's appealing to its conservative base, is pro-life. And there are a lot of women who are saying, you know, I might support guns, but I don't support this anti-abortion platform. Maybe the NRA isn't right for me. And so that's why I think they're hamstringing themselves by tying themselves to this Second Amendment equals conservatism equals culture war BS that they've started for the past several years now. I really wish they would get back to their core mission of fighting for Second Amendment rights and sponsoring gun ownership and gun safety and gun education. That's it. That's the only thing they need to talk about. And I fear that the appointment of North means that they're going to stray further from that, and we're going to get into more culture war bullshit, more us versus them rhetoric, and it bothers me. It really does. I think they're making a terrible mistake, and we'll just have to wait and see.
I agree. I think it's also a bad play in the fact that when I first was aware of the gun debate and I was rooting for the other side, it was, you know, the big name for the anti-guns was the Brady campaign, and the head of that was Paul Helmke. And Paul Helmke was a Republican, you know, maybe a more nominal Republican by some standards, but he was a Republican. And gun control was very much a bipartisan issue. So it was bipartisan on the gun control side, and, you know, not even left right, but just, you know, it was more of the extremists were the ones that were really waving the flag of the shall not be infringed. And no, we need guns for self-protection, because there was still also people talking about like, oh, no, we need guns so we can shoot ducks and deer. And that's the only reason. And now fast forward to now we're talking about self-defense, which is great because that is appealing to the urban population who maybe doesn't have access to ducks and deer nearly as much and absolutely positively need guns and being more inclusive. The anti-gun groups have skewed way to the left, way, way, way to the left. It is very, very hard to find a self-identified Republican in the anti-gun camp. There's a few of them, but not that many. And so, you know, when you look back at the 90s, the anti-gunners were winning. That was a winning strategy. Why would we not do that? Why would we not be big tent? Let's bring in everybody. And honestly speaking, let's bring them all in. I mean, that's the spirit of this show, is I've got my political views. You've got your political views. We've got all that. But this show does not. We talk politics, but we are not political in that sense of the, hey, man, you want to be a Democrat, you want to be pro-choice, you want to be pro-life, you want to, you know, socialize health care, and or you want to keep the government out of my everything. You want to be a super libertarian. You want to be a, you know, a religious conservative, whatever. So long as you support the Second Amendment, you're welcome here. That's awesome. I support that. Let's get that stone out of the way. And I think that would be a winning strategy for the NRA. And I hope that is the way it goes.
Yeah, I hope so too.
Well, okay, let's dive into the next subject here. We all know how investors buy low and sell high, and cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin have been shooting up in value. But are there ways to earn money with cryptocurrencies by other means? Savage will let us know in this week's Savage segment.
Sometimes it goes down, but mostly it goes up. Which way did the crypto roller coaster swing today? This is the Savage segment, and I am Jack Savage, and let's talk about crypto. So today I'm going to talk about how to passively earn cryptocurrency without having to put in a whole lot of effort. Before, I've talked about purchasing crypto with your USD or your fiat money, and I've talked about trading it to grow the value of your stack. But today we're going to talk about lending. And lending is something that you can do on a couple of the exchanges out there. Bitfinex was one of the ones I'd used previously, but because they closed their doors to US customers, people within the United States were then limited to Poloniex. And unfortunately for me, Poloniex shut its doors to Washington State, New York, and one other that I can't think of right now. So that option is not available to people who live in those states. However, if you live in states other than Washington, New York, and that mysterious other state, you should have no problems doing this whatsoever. So the first thing you're going to have to do is create an account on Poloniex. This will require you to sign in, upload your relevant identification information, like a driver's license, and get everything squared away. Once you've got an account, then you're going to need to go to the lending tab. So you've logged in. There's three tabs on the top: exchange, margin trading, and lending. And what lending does is it allows you to take whatever crypto you have on that given day, and you're lending it out to margin traders. And margin traders are those guys that go on to exchanges and they borrow money against the money they already have in order to place bets on whether the markets will go up or down in any given cryptocurrency. So in order to make it attractive for people to lend to margin traders, you need to be able to earn a percentage, and that's essentially what happens. You will give a certain amount of cryptocurrency, you will lend it out, so you'll have a certain amount, you'll lend it out, you'll set a duration, and you'll set your rate. Now, you can set your rate at whatever you want it to be manually, but it just really depends on what the demand for the day is. So the easiest way to find out what the general demand is to go onto a place called CoinLend.org. And what CoinLend.org does is it will take all the cryptocurrencies as well as fiat currencies, and it will place them in order as in which ones are in demand the highest. If I'm going on CoinLend.org right now, I can see that actually on Bitfinex, the Japanese yen is being lent out at a rate of 557% over a year. So the yearly rate is 557%, which is insane. So in theory, if you were outside of the US and you had a Bitfinex account, you could trade your crypto for the Japanese yen and lend it to margin traders in order for them to trade their yen versus Bitcoin or Litecoin or whatever other crypto they have. And you could lend it for a period, and I think the max period you're allowed to lend for is 30 to 60 days, and you would make a yearly rate would be 557%, so you'd have to break that down into whatever it would accrue over the period of time that you've lent it out for. Now, one thing to note is that the people who are borrowing your money do not have to keep that money for the entire time period. So say you've set your duration for 30 days and you've grabbed that really awesome lending rate of 557% over the period of a year, and it would break down however much per month. But they could actually drop that after a few days if it became unprofitable for them to be holding onto that money for that long. So what you would get is the interest that would have accrued over the time period of days that your money had been lent out, and the exchange does that math for you. So you can do this manually, where you, again, go into the lending section of Poloniex or Bitfinex or what have you, set your rate, set your amount, and set your duration.
and then wait for somebody to grab that loan and hold on to it, and then wait for them to drop it or for the time period to expire, and then you have to manually go back and do it again. Now, Poloniex does have an auto-renew, so you can set a given rate, and hopefully somebody will grab it from you and you will keep on getting that rate. The only problem is that the demand for lending goes up and it goes down. It rarely stays the same. So in periods of high demand, the lending rate might shoot up as much as 4% in a day, which over a year is freaking huge. Or it might dive down to a fraction of a percent in a day. So if you have your loan amount set at a fixed rate, you'll miss the higher rates that go up, and you won't catch any lending rates if the demand is below what you're asking for. So one tool that'll come in really handy for you is a bot. Now, the bot that I've used in the past and is extremely good, and I recommend it because it's extremely easy to use, is CryptoLend.net. So what you'll do is you'll go over to CryptoLend.net, and you can create an account. They have a grace period that will allow you to lend out a certain amount and gain interest on that amount, and you won't have to pay them until you reach however much money, like say it's $100 per se. So you can basically be lending out your cryptocurrency for free and having a bot do it for you. Now, the cool thing about a bot is that they can chase those moving levels of lending rates. So say I'm looking at Poloniex right now, and the rate per day is 0.02%, and maybe that rate would jump up to 4%. Now, if you have the bot activated and you have the settings correct, what will happen is that bot will actually chase the percentage on its way up and will lend out your money in intervals if you set the settings correctly. And you could have portions of your money catching you huge percentages and paying you back quite a bit over the period of a few days or a month even. The way you're going to need to connect your bot from CryptoLend to Poloniex is by getting the API keys. So from Poloniex, what you'll do is you'll scroll over the top tabs to the far right-hand side where you will see a wrench. You'll see two-factor authentication, API keys, trading to your status, login history, change password, and log out. What you'll want to do is click on your API keys. So you'll want to enable or make sure API access is enabled. You'll want to create a new key. So click on create new key, and hopefully you'll have set up two-factor authentication on your Poloniex account. So you'll enter in your two-factor authentication, and it will send you an email to confirm. You'll click on the link they send you in the email, and it will take you to your new API key. So you'll have an API key and your API secret, and you'll want to show that API secret so you can enable the bot. So once your secret is unlocked, you'll be able to view the secret as well as your API key. And then what you will do is make sure that neither enable trading or enable withdrawals are checked. So that will make sure that your bot does not have any access to trade or withdraw funds from your account. That's extremely important in the worst case scenario where the website and bot goes rogue. They won't have the ability to do anything. Poloniex blocks it on their side. So again, disable trading, make sure enable withdrawals is not checked, and then go over to CryptoLend.net, go to bots, and then you're going to create a Poloniex bot or activate it. So once you've created your bot, you're going to want to modify the settings on it. So there's a number of different currencies that they have that you can use. You can either use Bitcoin, Ethereum, Litecoin, XMR, BTS, Clam, Doge, Dash, Madecoin, STR, Ripple, and FCT. Those are the options you have under Poloniex. Personally, the ones I've used are Doge, Litecoin, and Bitcoin. So let's click on Modify and look at our expert mode settings. The other thing you're going to need to do is make sure that you have a balance that you can lend out. So what you're going to want to do is either purchase or transfer whatever cryptocurrency you have into your wallet. And once it's in your wallet, you can move it from whatever wallet you've transferred it into your lending wallet. And your lending account wallet will basically be what the bot accesses and uses that amount of funds to lend out. So for the sake of argument, let's go with Dogecoin. We're going to lend out some Dogecoin today. So going back to the lending bot, we're going to say, let's say we have 10,000 Doge. And I'm going to go through the settings, and these are the ones that I've used before, and I've had a really great return on my investment with. So going down the line, we're going to see keep amount, 0 Doge. Min depth amount is going to be 2 Doge. Max duration offer, 1 minute. Min offer amount, 0 Doge. Min offer rate, 0.0025% per day. Threshold long offer, 0.08% per day. Max loan durations, 2 days. And you can change any of these settings. You could even push that max loan duration out to 30 days, but I've seen best results out of 2 days because that's more attractive to margin traders. So strategies, under strategies, we're going to go automatic strategy on, max rate, 0.08% per day. Iceberg strategy, this is the important one, that's going to be on. And out of that 100,000 Doge, what I'm doing is I'm breaking it up into multiple chunks that are going to be lent out. So Iceberg max offer is going to be 40,000 Doge. So, you know, out of that 100,000, 40,000, let's say, or 30, 20, whatever, however you want to break it up, 40,000 is going to be lent out at a time. Initial split strategy is off. And then under alerts, we're going to have low use rate alert on, use rate limit 90%, and then that's pretty much it. So then you'd save all those settings, and then you'd click on activate lending. And once you've activated the lending on that bot, what it's going to do is it's going to use those API keys to access your Poloniex account, take the amount of funds in your lending account, and start putting it out there for margin traders to borrow. And that's pretty much it. At any time you want, you can go to your CryptoLend.net account, you can click on the dashboard, and you can see currently how your loans are doing. You can watch, and it will graph and show you your balance, how much your crypto is worth in USD. It'll show you how much you've gained using the bot. It'll show you the bot credits, and at some point you're going to have to fill the bot with Ethereum because that's how they process. Actually, I think you can fill it with a couple different types of crypto in order to pay them once you cross that threshold. But then it'll also show you the exchange, the gain you should see by tomorrow, the rate you're getting today, what's being used, total gain and balance. I know it sounds kind of crazy. It's something you have to play around with and get a feel for. But once you get it set up and running, it's one of those things that kind of just takes care of itself. So you can sit back, have a chunk of money on the exchange, go to CryptoLend.net, and just watch the bot work its magic, which is pretty cool. And I recommend Doge because though while you'll normally see its lending rates fairly low, and as I'm seeing it now, it's somewhere around 0.0043% per day. During times of extreme demand, that percentage, as I've seen it and I've caught it, it'll pump up to 4% a day. And if you can snag a 2-day loan or even a 30-day loan, you're making 4% on however much Doge you've got in there over 2, 10, 30 days, as long as the margin trader doesn't close out the loan. And that can be a pretty darn good return on investment. That's all I got for now. Catch me back next week where I'm going to talk about the next crazy thing, ICOs.
Yeah, I didn't understand most of that. Did you? I mean, he's clicking on things. He's talking about Iceberg strategy. I feel like I'm the dog when people are talking. You know, my head is turning and all I'm hearing is blah, 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 Aaron. Blah, 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 Aaron.
I didn't understand as much of it either, but I'm not really financially minded. So I was very interested to know that there was more stuff that you could do with your cryptocurrencies besides, you know, find people that also accept them and exchange them for items or do the buy low and sell high business. It certainly gives it a whole new perspective.
So here's the thing that gets me just about currency in general. And I learned this when I was taking a college economics course. And that is that once money progressed from the actually backed by a set amount of money in the bank and the Federal Reserve, things like that, it has gone to become just a hallucination we all agree on. I mean, banks don't have to have $50 million in order to loan it out. They just have to have, well, okay, we have enough people in the bank who have deposited this money, and so we can loan it out in theory to this other place, and then we can get interest on it, and then when they've paid it back, then in theory we have it. And it was just, yeah, I mean, banks were just inventing money out of whole cloth and getting paid to do it, and it was amazing to me. And now I see that they're doing the same thing with this cryptocurrency where they're borrowing it, but not really. And I'm just looking at this and going, this is sorcery. It's magic. I don't understand how they're just, how everyone just says, okay, guys, let's assume this thing has value. And everyone says, yeah, sure, why not? It blows my mind.
Yeah, as a little kid, I remember like my mom taking me to the bank to deposit her paycheck and or to make a withdrawal. And I just assumed that, oh, you know, they had a vault. There was a little safe and it said Mama Weird on the side of it. And when she said, oh, I'd like $100, they would go into the safe, they would undo the combination, open it up. It was Gringotts, and there was, you know, stacks of gold and gems and stuff inside there. And they would go and pull out what my mom wanted, and they were just keeping it safe. The money was always there. And I realized, no, it's not. They've got a little ledger that says how much money. And to go into other old-timey stuff, to say that this is like nothing new, was in It's a Wonderful Life. They have the run on the bank. Oh, everyone's trying to pull their money out of the bank. And they're like, oh, no, we can't have that happen. Why not? Well, that's because the bank has their money, but they don't have their money. So if everybody suddenly wants their money, the bank's not going to be able to pay that. And
yeah, it's really kind of weird to discover actually how much cash banks have on hand and how much they don't. Mm-hmm. And so what do they do with it? Well, they're loaning it out. They're earning interest on it. It's, oh, so weird.
Yeah, that's, I went into the sciences for a reason. So moving on.
Yeah, speaking of weird things which don't seem right, this week information was revealed that members of the government under the Obama administration were spying on the presidential campaign of Donald Trump. Connie takes a good look at the very serious implications of this in this week's Washington in Plain English.
Hi, Aaron. Hi, Weird. The last time I was on, I discussed some of why we needed to start talking about a new National Security Act, and some of what that means. Today, I am here to relate a story about how a lack of clear limitations on authority and a lack of effective oversight can threaten our rights to privacy and conscience. On the 20th of May, Jonathan Turley of George Washington University Law School wrote a piece for The Hill entitled, After a Year of Investigation, Trump Can Rightly Claim Some Vindication. He said, The New York Times this week disclosed that the FBI made a conscious effort to use secret counterintelligence powers to investigate Trump officials and may have had a confidential informant who was used in connection with key Trump figures long before the November 2016 election. Officials stated anonymously that this was a long-standing source who worked with both the FBI and CIA for years. In early 2017, President Trump was widely ridiculed for alleging that the Obama administration placed his campaign under surveillance. The response from experts on CNN and other sites was open mockery. former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper came forward to assure the media that he could categorically deny the allegation and stated there was no such wiretap activity mounted against the president-elect at the time, or as a candidate or against his campaign, end quote. The range of media analysis seemed to run from whether Trump was a clinical paranoid or a delusional demagogue. We now know there was indeed surveillance ordered repeatedly on Trump campaign figures before and after the election. Rather than acknowledge the troubling implications of an administration investigating the opposing party's leading candidate for president, the media shifted to saying there was ample reason to order the surveillance. Okay, there's more information in the article, and Cheryl Atkinson's website has a wonderful timeline, and there's a New York Times story from last week about Crossfire Hurricane. All the links will be on the show page this week. So now that I've given you that intro, let's leave aside the argument about credibility and ask ourselves for a moment the worst case. What if this is all true? To anyone concerned about preserving our freedoms, the answers should be chilling. If the stories bear out, then a cabal of people placed into positions of trust and authority in the United States government decided to investigate the political campaign of a member of the opposition party. They had no probable cause for a criminal investigation, so they decided to institute a counterintelligence investigation. Only they had no intelligence to warrant it. To make it seem as if they had, these people managed to secure a copy of an opposition research document on the target, written for the candidate from their own party. It was written by a retired British intelligence operative. When they presented this information to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, they buried mention of the origin and funding of the document in a footnote in the middle of the request for authorization. They were not forthcoming with the court in their presentation about the funding, nor were they forthcoming about whether or not they were able to verify all the parts in the document that were triggering the investigation. Having secured that authorization, this investigative group then paid for the services of at least one human intelligence asset, read, spy. That is, the actual real spy kind of spy, who does the kind of things that the United States government does not want on its full-time payroll. They paid this asset to embed himself into the campaign, to start reporting on activities, and now, it appears, possibly even set up campaign figures to commit acts for which they could be prosecuted. In the midst of all this, the Department of Justice has attempted to advance the specious argument that despite the fact that their authority comes from the Constitution through the President of the United States, that they operate independently of the President as a check on his power. And they've attempted to claim that the actual check on their authority, oversight from the United States Congress, is, and I quote, extortion. The Department of Justice has used this argument as part of their attempt to stonewall their congressional oversight committees by not revealing the identity of their asset or assets when requested, claiming the necessity of protecting their sources in a counterintelligence investigation. As Kimberly Strassel has tweeted, the fact that they've disclosed these details to friendly media outlets raises questions about the legitimacy of their objections. So also is the fact that the Department of Justice has attempted to conceal the scope of their investigation into candidate Trump's campaign from congressional oversight and from their duly elected boss, President Trump. Last week, Professor Turley also wrote that the transcript reveals a largely consistent and entirely plausible account of a meeting of chumps, not conspirators. The statement drafted by President Trump on Air Force One was misleading in failing to mention the original purpose of the meeting. But if such spins were crimes in Washington, there would not be a single politician left at liberty. He wrote that the Trump Tower meeting is now ready for Occam's razor. Those 20 minutes have resulted in more than a year of investigation, countless hours of testimony, and tens of thousands of documents. The most obvious explanation, with the least assumptions, is that this was a case of blind and reckless desire overcoming judgment. It's called a razor precisely because it shaves away unnecessary, or in this case, partisan assumptions. When you shave away the unsupported facts, the Trump Tower meetings appear hardly complimentary, but entirely legal. So I ask, who guards the guardians? If the stage of a presidential campaign is no longer enough to restrain their hands in this day and age, then what possibly can? It's gotten so bad that even one of President Clinton's former pollsters, Mark Penn, has spoken up. He wrote for The Hill that the Mueller investigation must be stopped to protect the institutions of our nation itself, that, quote, stopping Mueller isn't about one president or party. It's about all presidents and all parties. It's about cleaning out and reforming the deep state so that our intelligence operations are never used against opposing campaigns without the firmest of evidence. It's about letting people work for campaigns and administrations without needing legal defense funds. It's about relying on our elections to decide our differences. Those of us who have been watching the security state for some time could see that the day was coming when these powers would be turned against an opposition party candidate. Diane Rourke, Bill Binney, Tom Drake, Kurt Wiebe, and Ed Loomis had those powers turned against them after serving our government for many years because they opposed the NSA's Trailblazer program. They went through years of investigation for espionage after being fired from their jobs in government, and they've had their retirements threatened. Back in 2013, Ms. Rourke said to PBS's Frontline, I think what has happened is that this has trickled down from we initially became a national security state. We are now becoming a police state in which this huge database with everything on everybody is being used for criminal prosecutions. That's a police state. That is our liberties just simply evaporating. And it is not only going to be used for criminal prosecutions, it's going to be used against political enemies. And we are the canaries, the five of us. We are the canaries in the coal mine. We never did anything wrong. All we did was oppose this program. And for that, they just ran over us. But it will all have been worth it if the U.S. public gets away from this view, I don't have anything to hide. I cannot understand how people can say such a thing. They don't know history. They don't know political theory. They don't realize that if you believe in anything, it can be used against you. If you have any political beliefs at all, it can be used against you by the opposition if they're in power. End quote. The very technical capability for this kind of perpetual spying on Americans, let alone the legal authorities to do that, were not ever supposed to exist within the powers originally granted by the National Security Act and the subsequent related legislation. Instead, the national security community saw imminent threats, and they seized these powers, at times convincing Congress to make those powers legal retroactively. We need to be concerned. James Madison warned us, of all the enemies to public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes. And armies and debts and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few. In war, too, the discretionary power of the executive is extended. Its influence in dealing out offices, honors, and emoluments is multiplied, and all the means of seducing the minds are added to those of subduing the force of the people. The same malignant aspect in republicanism may be traced in the inequality of fortunes and the opportunities of fraud growing out of a state of war and in the degeneracy of manners and morals engendered by both. No nation could preserve its freedom in the midst of continual warfare. Unfortunately, we don't live in the kind of world that many of the founders hoped for, where their goal for American foreign policy, to make and keep peace between ourselves and among all nations, can yet be realized. We thus need to permit our guardians some authorities to protect our homes from threats that are able to change and adapt rapidly. The late economist Jack Hirschleifer opened one of his books with the statement, all exchange takes place in the shadow of conflict. And that's the world we live in today, where low-scale conflict is constant, and the Westphalian nation-state system is being challenged by state actors who reject that notion of statehood entirely, like the People's Republic of China, and by some state actors who either reject the ideas behind the nation-state system, such as the political Islamist movement that came from Sayyid Qutb and that spawned Al-Qaeda and ISIS, or other sub-state actors that seek to create vast undergoverned spaces in which to operate, such as the transnational cartels that come from Mexico and Central America that do everything from trafficking in drugs to trafficking in people. These adversaries and others have their agents living among us. They're here to steal our secrets, to harm our firms. Some of them are here to convert many of our number to their cause or to kill us. These threats are real, and they're imminent. We must survive, but we must also defend our freedoms. But our guardians have escaped the constraints we've placed around them. So as we think about what we need in order to survive in today's world, we need to ask ourselves, what does it mean to be a free and self-governing people in the face of forces that threaten our survival, even though the response to them will erode our liberty? How will we codify those needs, our needs, into new law to protect us in the future? Okay, that's it for this week. See you next time.
Still feel like the dog is listening to its own name?
No, unfortunately, I understood all of this, and I didn't like it.
No. No, this is the type of behavior that it seems like it's getting ever more present as time goes on, of just overstepping of political powers, and I don't like it one bit.
I don't like it either. The thing is, I don't know how we can fix this. I'm starting to think that the corruption is so entrenched that it can't be fixed, that we're rapidly approaching just the slash and burn mentality. And unfortunately, in that analogy, this means, well, some sort of violent overthrow of the government or civil war. And I really don't want that. I really wish there was a way we could fix this without going the nooses and lamppost routes. But I'm the more these things are revealed, the less hope I have, and the more cynical I become. This is Stasi-level crap here. This is bad. This is really bad. We should not stand for this as a people. But we are, because we don't know what we can do about it. What was that thing of Claire Wolfe? We're at that awkward stage where voting doesn't do any good, but we're not quite at the stage where it's time to start stringing the bastards up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, we've just got this partisan politics thing where, you know, one side manages to get their hold of the election and they vote themselves more power, not at all assuming that the other side is eventually going to get the, you know, win the election and they're going to get the reins of all that power. But meanwhile, instead of it being a correction, no, the other side just also votes itself more power to use differently, just back and forth. And I wish to say that I could see someone ratcheting it back. I mean, you know, politics are a slow process. It took us many, many years to get to where we are. It's going to take us many, many years to get back, but we have to first start going back.
That's true. But here's the problem. We are experiencing an inverse pendulum effect. Usually with the pendulum, it goes slowly towards the median. But it seems like each administration is more radically one side or another, and we just keep swinging further left, further right, more this, more that, as an attempt to correct, and eventually something's going to break.
I hope I'm not there when it happens.
I know. I apologize to everyone who's listening. I'm in a very cynical mood right now. I hope it passes. So you know what would cheer me up right about now?
What would that be, Aaron?
A patented weird audio fisk where you just rip some officious, sanctimonious know-it-all a new one. Can you do that for me?
Not just one sanctimonious know-it-all, several of them. See, I found some audio from the Brady campaign. They call it Gun Violence 101, as if it's a college course. except it's a college course of nothing but lies. So here is part one of that audio fisk. Oh boy, there's something magical about just outright lying. In this week's Weird Audio Fisk, I'm going to take down a video from the Brady campaign called Gun Violence 101. It's an editorial video that's entirely composed of lies. Here's the interesting thing about just setting up your camera and telling lies. It takes way more effort to properly debunk a lie than it does to tell one. So the video I'm tackling is only about 5.5 minutes long, but it's going to take about 2 10-minute fisks for me to squash them all. And that's just talking about the time it's going to take for me to physically rebut these lies, not the time it took me to research and compose my rebuttals. And not the time it's going to take for you to review the show notes and see that while they're a bunch of damn dirty liars, I'm actually telling the truth. I don't think the Brady campaign expects anybody to actually fact check them. Well, buckle up, because here we go.
Our reality is that American kids and teens live with the fear of coming under attack in their classrooms. This fear is a uniquely American part of childhood. No child should ever worry about going to school.
See? Total lie. First up, school shootings are insanely rare. So rare that when one does happen, it makes the national news for weeks. When you pass a fender bender on the highway, do you hear about it in the local news? No, because fender benders are insanely common. And despite them being so common, are kids scared to hop in the family sedan? If your kids are scared to go to school for fear of school shootings, it's you, the parent, who are guilty of putting unreasonable fears into the heads of your children. Also, this isn't uniquely American. Most nations also experience school shootings. And many nations have problems that seem strange and alien to us, like mass school stabbings and school arson. These events are insanely rare. Just due to the size of the United States, rare things are a little bit more common here. When you look at the EU as a whole and adjust for population, the EU has a similar number of mass shootings, despite the insane number of gun laws they have over there.
Each year, there are dozens of gun-related incidents in schools that result in trauma, injuries, and deaths.
Okay. This one is barely a fact. What does dozens mean? Are we talking about 24 or 24? That seems about right. And exceedingly rare. Honestly, when you note the size of the United States and the number of schools here, 10 dozen is still super rare. But I don't know what numbers to address here. Or even if they are legitimate numbers, because the Brady campaign doesn't cite their sources. But I do, because I actually have integrity.
Roughly 5% of kids under the age of 18 have witnessed a shooting.
I think I found the study they're citing, and I have it linked in the show notes. I say think because, again, they don't cite their sources. In this study, witness, when it comes to shootings, is exactly what we might think. Seeing somebody get shot or shot at. But it also counts simply hearing gunshot. This study did focus on high crime areas. So maybe hearing some gunshots is synonymous with violence. But in cities, people also buy fireworks, even when they're illegal. They're kind of like guns in that way. And like guns in gang-infested cities, cops really aren't all that interested in rounding up the people illegally blowing up cherry bombs and bottle rockets. Maybe your local gang is icing a rival gang member, or maybe they're lighting off a few firecrackers at a backyard barbecue. Further, I wonder how many of these witnesses are children of pearl-clutching anti-gunners who tell their kids every time a hunter shoots at a deer or zeroes his rifle on a berm or target shoots at an outdoor range or even a car backfires that's some crazy gun nut out for murder.
And while we don't know the intent behind every shooting, past research shows 2/3 of guns used in school shootings actually come from the home of the shooter or their relative.
Well, yeah. Most of the high-profile school shootings, the killer had been an adult and bought their guns legally. Furthermore, I don't know what definition they're using for school shooting. The FBI has their definitions, and Michael Bloomberg and his followers cooked up their own definition that includes any shooting of any kind, including suicides, and even if it's near a school. So if somebody commits suicide in their dorm room, or in the parking lot of a school, even when school's not in session at the time, that's a school shooting. And if the local drug dealer that lives in the same block as a school has a shootout and a bullet doesn't even enter school property, that's a school shooting. So yeah, Suicides are almost always committed with a personally owned firearm. Not sure how they classify the criminal element, but even those guys generally get their guns from family or friends.
Children are growing up in an age where more and more schools are conducting drills to prepare for these types of shootings. Over two-thirds of schools have had school shooter drills in 2016. We should refuse to accept this as a new normal.
This is just a rat's nest of broken logic. I believe 100% of schools conduct fire drills. School fires are relatively rare, but we practice drills because fire is dangerous. School shootings are even more rare than school fires, but they're dangerous too. And you're the guys making a video where you're talking about school shootings like they're an everyday occurrence. So let me get this straight. You want me to be scared that my kids are going to be murdered in school, but you don't want us to actually do anything about it? Okay, they're the Brady campaign. They don't want us to do anything, unless it involves banning guns.
Unintentional shootings, most of which happen in the home, affect kids and teens at surprisingly high rates. 76% of kids ages 5 to 14 know where firearms are kept, which is a huge problem considering more than 1.7 million kids live in homes where guns are unlocked and loaded.
Notice he's citing exact numbers when it comes to kids knowing where guns are kept at home, and how many of those homes don't lock up their guns, but doesn't give any quantity on the surprisingly high rate of unintentional shootings of children in the home. Well, according to Every Town for Gun Safety, a wholly owned subsidiary of Michael Bloomberg Incorporated, the same group that cooked up those massively inflated school shooting numbers, there have been 888 unintentional shootings of children since 2015. That's 292 shootings per year. Let's round that up to 300. The U.S. population, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, is 325 million, rounded down to the nearest million. And the data group classifies children as people under the age of 18. Some anti-gun studies will call people under 26 children. And according to the Census Bureau, 24% of the population, so 78 million, are children under the age of 18, making those 300 accidental shootings represent 0.04% of the population. So it's so surprisingly high that the calculator won't show the answer to my math without scientific notation. And that's using Michael Bloomberg's own numbers, of which I'm deeply skeptical of, and heavily rounding the numbers to make sure any rounding errors fall in the favor of the anti-gunners. Oh, and only about a third of those shootings are fatal. Now that the first numbers are exposed, and you know with the amount of numbers and percentage thrown around, that wasn't unintentionally omitted. See, even if their numbers of kids knowing where guns are kept at home and the numbers of guns that are unlocked are true, and I'm skeptical of that, it really isn't an issue. Of course, I'm a huge proponent of safety, and if you have kids in the home, lock them up. But these numbers are showing that you law-abiding gun owners are doing a great job at keeping the kids safe.
So the truth is, while high-profile mass shootings are in the media quite often, hundreds of shootings happen every week that don't get enough media attention.
Because most of those shootings are suicides. The bulk of the other shootings are violent crime numbers, which are not carried out by people who can legally own guns. Anti-gunners use these numbers when they're convenient, such as implying, incorrectly, that the United States is a dangerous nation, but ignoring them when, say, Chicago has 2,785 shootings in 2017, down from 3,550 incidents in 2016, and yet has all the gun laws the antis could dream about.
About 60% of gun deaths are suicides, and roughly 85% of suicide attempts with a gun are fatal.
Yes, but do Americans consider this a gun problem or a suicide problem? Also, directly citing suicide numbers, rather than just rolling them into homicide numbers to inflate the body count, is always done with the implication that guns somehow cause suicide. And stating how many suicides by gun are fatal implies that if people don't have that option, never mind that to take that option off the table would require a near total gun ban, there would be less people who would die by their own hands. Except when you look at the suicide numbers by nation, the United States is right in the middle of the pack. There are lots of nations above us, who heavily restrict gun ownership, I might add, who have higher rates of suicide than us. And when compared with the UK, which we share a lot of common culture with, but not a Second Amendment, our suicide rates are about the same. So guns simply can't be causing suicides.
35% of gun deaths are homicides. The other 5% are unintentional shootings or those killed by law enforcement.
We already touched on the unintentional shooting numbers. They're almost nothing. Law enforcement shootings are quite low as well, despite what the evening news might tell you. Also, self-defense shootings are in those numbers. But when the bulk of self-defense with a firearm involves no shots being fired, the body count for that group is right there with the accidental death. So we're only dealing with about a third of all deaths by firearms being violent crime. You've all read The Myth of the Virgin Killer by now, right? It's in the show notes if you haven't. Murderers don't just spring out of the ground. They escalate their antisocial behavior and almost always have contact with law enforcement before they kill, and generally have been through the law system enough that by the time they pull the trigger on another human being, they can't legally own the gun they're shooting. This is not a failure of guns. This is a failure of gun laws. I need to break now. I'll give you part two next week. Those are your anti-gun talking points and a few rebuttals to combat them.
Weird, that was a very heroic effort of you, and you have perfectly embodied Brandolini's law, which states that the amount of energy needed to refute BS is an order of magnitude bigger than to produce it.
Yeah, it's easy just to stand there, look at the camera, and say a lie versus detecting the lie, looking up the truth, and posting the references in the show notes so that you can see where I got the truth, and then refuting that lie. So yeah, you just listened to an audio fisk that is twice the length of the video that I'm fisking, and I only covered half the video.
Wow.
So we'll have more of this next week.
Well, I think it's time for the house dick.
And if you left at that line, you'll love this segment. Stephen talks to us this week about how a private investigator goes about the daily necessities when on surveillance.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Tales from the Trunk, Episode 5, otherwise known as What to Do When You Have to Poo, or as I like to often call it, the No Shit Sherlock Rule. So as Erin mentioned in the last episode, she had a pile of questions. This particular segment aims to answer a few of them. For everything you didn't ever want to know about working and spending a large amount of time in a confined space. Yay! This so far has been the hardest segment I've had to flesh out the requisite amount of content. So Erin, weird being the slave drivers that they are, I've had to put my nose to the steering wheel and make another mad dash towards content creation deadlines. All of this without a stunt double and a spare change of clothing. Of course, first things first. Number one is handled with a plastic bottle of some type that can be disposed of as needed. In the hood, no one will see you wee, and the homeless folk do it wherever anyhow. Hand sanitizer is, of course, your friend. As for number two, I will wait until I'm done with my case and I'll go to a clean facility somewhere. Usually it has to be outside of the city of Detroit because, well, when you have to be buzzed into many restrooms, sometimes they are less than sanitary. Picture a port-a-john in an actual structure. That's most of them in the city of Detroit, so yeah. Pre-work constitutionals are your friends, folks, especially in this particular line of work. Now, with regards to number two, I've actually had to fire people who've gone off-site to do their business, one or two. I know it sounds harsh, and I really don't like to do it, but we're paid good money to sit out here on our asses. And, well, to be perfectly honest with you, all it takes is 5 or 10 seconds and your target is in the wind and you ain't got a clue as to where they went, which means you're out of work the rest of the day and you've got to explain to your boss, me, why you lost your target. If you're having bowel issues of any sort, I would highly suggest taking the day off. Our particular line of work, we do have days where things might be date specific and that sort of thing. But generally, our schedules are pretty adaptive. And as Erin and Weird both know, I keep really, really weird hours. The nice thing, of course, about working alone is if you're a plague vector of any sort, parents of young children know that their grubby little sproglings tote everything home with them from school. And that usually means they carry them where they go. Now, having an assortment of meds on hand to keep sniffles, cold, flu, and stomach upset to a minimum are a must in my gear bag. Lysol wipes are also a very, very nice thing to have, along with your requisite glass cleaner and everything else. Have you ever sneezed on a windshield? Not a pretty sight. With regards to being sedentary in general, very similar to an office worker who's at his desk in a cubby farm somewhere, I try to stretch. That can mean torso stretches, arm lifts, leg lifts, that sort of thing. I do keep a small set of free weights and grip strength machines in the car in order to keep myself at least mildly entertained. As some of my close friends have probably noted recently, I do have the occasional Chinese fire drill when the coast is clear and the weather's nice. Because that little burst of energy and activity can get your blood pumping and keep you from falling asleep. It can also help keep you limber and prevent joint and muscle cramps. And again, we'll get our entertainment any way we can. Which includes, you know, podcast segments and poop jokes. So, the biggest particular problem I've had in my umpteen years behind the wheel is snacking. Between 2002 and late 2016, I gained about 50 pounds. I've since lost all that weight with semi-regular exercise and actually watching what I eat. Now, a lot of my friends that are more physically active and are fitness buffs and stuff like that like to rag on Planet Fitness, but for their hours and for my schedule, it's been an absolute lifesaver. And it's just a matter of taking the initiative. I've seen, and I've actually had one or two guys, older gentlemen, die on my watch of old age and heart conditions. So I really don't want to go that way, and I really don't intend to spend the rest of my adult life as I approach middle age sitting in a car all day. Now, you know, with regards to the snacking, of course, most days, especially in the summer, I'm toting gallon water jugs with me to work. I'll usually go through at least a gallon and a half of water. And I pack a healthy snack, you know, fruit, nuts, trail mix, granola, whatever you want, protein bars. And I usually keep powdered protein supplements in my little itty-bitty lunchbox. Those will help, you know, keep off hunger pangs and just generally keep me alert and prevent me from hitting the gas station buffet because, you know, gas station sushi is bad, folks. It's really bad. Don't do it. So, with all that being said, this entire segment has really been one big crapshoot. So, Aaron, thanks for the content. And, weird, sorry about the curse words, but, you know, poop jokes, that sort of stuff happens. So, next week's segment, I'm going to try and cover something I saw recently on the interwebs, and most other people with the podcast have probably heard about the resurrection of Magnum P.I. I'll give a little bit of my insight regarding the trailer and Hollywood in general. When it comes to the PI as depicted in TV shows and movies. So, as always, don't forget to feed and water your favorite neighborhood trunk monkey. Donations of money and ammunition are always welcome at ACP. Have a good one, guys. Later.
I am so proud of this because I actually asked Steven these point-blank questions. You know, when you're, like, on surveillance, how do you poop? And things like that. And I didn't think he'd turn it into a segment, but he did. And I'm just so happy that he got into the really grim details about all of this. It really puts you there at the scene, doesn't it?
I've got to say, this is, like, the first time when I've been, ooh, I did make the right choice. Like, That amount of stuck in the car really wouldn't have worked well with me. Like, okay, I was stuck on boats, and sometimes I was stuck on very, very small boats. Like, I, you know, spent a week on a 35-foot fiberglass hull boat. Like, that was tight with like four other dudes. That was tight quarters. But at least you're up and walking around and slinging fish around and you're out in the air. Oh, man, just to be kind of stuck in the car and just having like a Chinese fire drill where you're getting out and running around the car, being like a relief. Ouch. Like, I don't know, man. That might be a bridge too far.
So sifting through someone's garbage isn't a bridge too far, but being cooped up in a car is. You have some interesting priorities, Weird.
Sifting through garbage, it's kind of like a really dirty scavenger hunt. It's a scavenger hunt with actual scavengers.
You are a strange, silly duckling.
Well, they call me Weird Beard for a reason. I didn't make up that name.
Okay, what is the reason? I mean, I just assumed it was because you had a crazy beard.
No, it was just literally nobody called me anything but my given name up until I grew a beard, and then suddenly people started calling me Weird Beard. Because I guess I was always strange, but it didn't roll off the tongue nearly as well until suddenly there was the beard to add to it. But yeah, the beard's never been too much different than this. It was kind of messy when I first got it because I didn't know how to trim a beard, but I sure had one.
So basically what they were saying is that you were a bearded weirdo.
That is exactly what they were saying. The weird does not modify the beard. It modifies me.
Okay. Good to know.
And I like it a little bit better than Perky Beard.
You know, perky is a disgusting adjective that should really only be appended to cheerleaders and breasts.
And morning people.
No, that's still disgusting. I don't understand how morning people do it. Ugh.
Well, thanks to all, to every one of you who tuned in today for the Assorted Calibers podcast. Special thanks to our Patreon members for their continued support. Become a Patreon patron at patreon.com/assortedcaliberspodcast. You get early access to our weekly shows, as well as bonus content, including the hilarious ACP blooper reel. The second blooper reel will be released shortly to Patreon members only. You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
You can find me at my nerd blog at lurkingrhythmically.blogspot.com and at my emergency preparedness blog, bluecollarprepping.blogspot.com.
You can hear more from Savage at the We Like Shooting Show, also on the Firearms Radio Network. Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
His beard isn't weird, but his breasts sure are perky. And I'm a pretty, pretty pony princess. We're strange, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.